stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm dedicating the entire show to a review of The Winter's Tale, a Shakespeare production at the Oslo Repertory Theatre, an interview with its director, that is the director of The Winter's Tale, and also the producing artistic director of the Oslo Repertory Theatre, Michael Donald Edwards, and an interview with Jason Wells, whose play Perfect Mendacity is also directed by Michael Edwards and will be premiering soon at the Oslo Rep. So, stay tuned. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
welcome to The Lynn Show. If you've been listening for the last few weeks, you know that I have been dedicating half of my show to airing a review of a play that is currently now being performed at the Oslo Repertory Theatre in Sarasota, Florida, and then an interview with someone important to the production, the star, the director, the choreographer. In today's show, I'm dedicating the whole show to an interview with Michael Donald Edwards, who's the producing artistic director of the Oslo Theater. I'm prefacing that interview with a review of A Winter's Tale, which I played a couple of weeks ago. But Michael Edwards directed The Winter's Tale, and we'll talk a great deal about it in this interview. Primarily, I was interviewing him because he's also directing Perfect Mendacity, which will open soon at the Oslo. And so, following his interview, there'll be a small musical break, and then an interview with Jason Wells, who's the writer of Perfect Mendacity. The Oslo Repertory Theater is one of the few really fully functioning repertory theaters in the United States. And this is an opportunity to listen to what informs one producing director as he makes his vision real. So now I'm going to play Sharon Leslie's review of A Winter's Tale, followed by a remarkably exciting, lively, surprising, unexpected interview with Michael Donald Edwards, and then a tiny musical break, and then a really thoughtful and reflective interview with Jason Wells.
Since The Winter's Tale is not considered one of Shakespeare's better works, I expected to be disappointed by the play and the production, no matter how hard it tried. Boy, was I wrong. The Oslo Repertory Theater's artistic director, Michael Donald Edwards, brings an imaginative vision to the play, making this production both exciting to watch and relevant to today. Director Edwards sets the story in our recent past, opening in the Eisenhower period of 1953 with a color palette of black and white and red. Then, as Shakespeare wrote, the action is transported 16 years, landing in this production into 1969 with a psychedelic rush of hippie colors and swirls. When set in the modern era, the impulsive misuse of power and judicial charade that are at the core of The Winter's Tale suggest parallels to the wrongs of McCarthyism and possibly even Gitmo and Abu Ghraib. Edwards gently reminds us that tyranny can be found anywhere, anytime. The Winter's Tale blends tragedy and comedy, unusual with Shakespeare. The story begins with Leontes, king of Sicilia, hosting a visit with his best friend since childhood, Polixenes, who is king of Bohemia. Since Leontes cannot talk his friend into staying longer, he asks his wife, Hermione, to try. When she is successful, Leontes is overcome with jealousy, thinking that his wife and Polixenes are lovers. What ensues due to Leontes' unfounded jealousy sets into motion the rest of the story, much of which continues in Bohemia, where, unknown to Leontes, his daughter Perdita is raised by an old shepherd. She falls in love with Florizel, the disguised son of Polixenes, and the comic aspects of the tale begins. Dan Donahue is excellent as Leontes, revealing both the tyrannical insane aspects of the king's jealousy and the humbler, repentant man he becomes. Chris Danforth brings beauty and moral fortitude as the unjustly accused and punished Hermione. As Paulina, Hermione's devoted friend, Mercedes Herrero is fiery and compelling as she courageously stands up to Leontes in defense of her best friend. Heather Kelly and Kevin O'Callaghan are charming as the young lovers Perdita and Florizel. And the comic portrayal of the old shepherd and his son by actors James Clark and David Yurta is marvelous, especially hearing Elizabethan English spoken with a southern hillbilly accent. At the end of 3 hours, the play seems much shorter. In this highly theatrical production, there's much to watch. A fluid set that changed locations with ease, projections that added to the mood and settings, the glorious costumes, the original musical numbers and dances, as well as using familiar songs from Hair, and well-drawn characters by each actor. If it sounds like I liked it, you'd be right. It was a fun night of theater that just happened to be Shakespeare.
Okay, so I am here with Michael Edwards, who is, what's your official title?
Producing Artistic Director of Oslo Repertory Theatre. Sarasota, Florida. It means that I'm responsible. It's an extraordinary team of people who make this happen.
But the final responsibility is really
yours.
Yes,
for the artistic product.
Yes.
And producing it and making the basic choices. It's kind of, it's a wonderful privilege and a responsibility to do it, to have a board of directors and a community and an institution trust one person's vision. And that's what they've given me.
Yes.
Amazing.
Wow, it's a huge responsibility. And also, as I listen to you, I realize it is. It's a great gift. It's an honor, isn't it?
It really is an honor where, and this is what happens with arts organizations, where they say, actually, we want a person to be the artistic head to actualize a vision. Now, a vision, of course, is a collective thing, but there has to be someone articulating it.
I just want to tell you, I saw Winter's Tale. It was amazing.
It's a beautiful piece, isn't it? People don't know it.
No, and that's actually what my reviewer said, that it's a little-known Shakespeare play. And,
yes.
She was just blown away by it.
Oh, I'm very pleased to hear that. I mean, that's a thing. And it's gotten a pretty amazing response, because it's a real journey you go on.
Yes.
And it's one of his late plays. He clearly had a whole issue with jealousy and a belief that we all deserve a second chance.
Yes.
And no matter how badly we screw up, we deserve a second chance.
I'm getting tears in my eyes. and the
play really does do that.
It does.
Takes you on a whole spiritual journey. And it's fun. It's really fun.
Yes,
as
it
well.
Is. Yes. And it manipulates you, right? Because, I mean, you're angry at him. And,
yes.
You know, and then you're not sure whether he deserves a second chance. Right. And then you're glad when he gets it.
Glad he says, and if she can forgive him, then we can
too.
Then
we can too. That's
you
right.
You know, it's really... And I think earlier in Shakespeare's career, there wouldn't have been a second chance. Would have ended badly. But he needed to go through that, because it's pretty intense what he does. He's always had this vast, generous spirit. But I think Othello is pretty unforgiving about jealousy. Nobody gets a second chance.
Right.
Master Ford in Merry Wives of Windsor is a ludicrous figure of jealousy. I mean, he's just an idiot. And this one, Leontes, is eaten up with it.
Yes.
And his whole family is broken apart and the country suffers. But when the young kids grow up,
yes.
It's a new generation and things get forgiven and you don't hang back in the past and you don't hang on to, we've got one go round.
Yes.
You may as well forgive.
Yes.
Otherwise,
it destroys you.
Yes. Yeah, totally. And, it's a tremendous opportunity for designers and actors and everything to do their thing. It was kind of beautiful to look at, wasn't it?
Yes, it was beautiful to look at. You have everything.
Yes, yeah, you have everything. Dancing, music,
yes,
choreography.
That's right.
Rock music.
Right.
Sets, costumes. It's a video. I mean, we had everything in there. When I think about it now.
What I'm trying to do with this series is interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly you are doing that.
I've been incredibly lucky. There's a group of us who talk about this, that we've been allowed somehow to live a life where we've only done our art.
Yes.
And that's a pretty marvelous thing.
It's remarkable and rare,
mm-hmm,
in our culture.
Yes. Yeah.
So one of the things I always ask is, how did this happen to you? How did it find you? How did you find it? How did it begin?
It's interesting, because I went to a Catholic boys' school that had absolutely no emphasis on art.
Wow.
It was all about sports. Through to high school, I graduated from it and I went to university. I got a great classical education, Latin and history and literature, but no experience of theater.
Wow.
Or the arts. At all, really, except Shakespeare. But we never saw any performances of Shakespeare. When I got to university at the age of 17, all that began to change as I got exposed to the world of art and literature and theater. I wanted to be a priest. Then I wanted to be a teacher. There was always been this little...
Performance. It's all about performance.
Well, and a kind of sense of mission.
Yes.
Sense of mission and
yes,
and belief in a life beyond the mere survival.
Yes.
You know, that there was a world of spirit. And when I got to university and was studying philosophy and history and all this, organized religion fell away, became untenable, you know, to actually subscribe to this. But the world of the spirit and the yearning for all of that doesn't go away. When you reject organized religion, you still have a sense of wrestling with life's meaning and the fact that we all die and, you know, what does it mean? That doesn't go away.
No.
Just when you say, I don't want anything more to do with the Vatican, doesn't mean you don't have a life of the spirit.
Well, forgive me, and this is an interpretation of what you're saying, but that's limited and rigid. And so when you let go of the limits and the rigidity...
That was certainly my experience.
Mm-hmm.
That was certainly my experience, that I was brought up in a very conservative religious environment which gave me a great deal.
A foundation.
Yes, but it was also the great prison,
yes,
intellectually and emotionally and artistically, that I had to break free of. This is a very, very conventional story. And many, many people go through this and, you know, have to let go. I was not brought up in a family or had an education that was artistically inclined. But they always encouraged me and they always supported me. And it was at the university that I kind of got completely caught up in the world of theatre and knew probably by the age of 19 that this is what I wanted to do, that I wanted to be involved in theatre. I did an honours degree in English literature, I wanted to be an academic for a while, but really it was the theatre that drew me in. And my first job was a follow spot I read for the Australian Opera.
Wow.
And that triggered my interest in opera. And you know, and I taught for a while at a college. I did 2 years teaching at a college and got grants to go to England. And it all kept guiding me towards the theatre, and I eventually got did a graduate degree at UCLA. And it's never not been part of what I've done.
It sounds like you got on this track and it took you.
Yeah, and I never had to really choose, do I go down this road or not? I was already going down the road, and when I think about it, it was a road that the seeds were being planted very young. I mean, I was interested in movies a great deal. I loved music. I was always listening to music, and I was always playing games, theatre games. My sisters tell me that I used to play mass all the time. And I was the priest, and I made all my sisters be the altar boys. And they still remember me doing this sort of thing, as well as cowboys and Indians.
Yes. So you were always play acting in one way or another.
I was always doing games. That element, when I think about it, was there, and I dressed them up, and it's like there's an element of playing a game.
Yes.
Which is why we call them plays.
Yes.
Kids playing games using their imaginations, they get transported, they get lost in the game, and I think that is what we try to do in the theatre all the time. Get the audience to that place where they're getting lost in the game, and the actors get lost in the game. We need it, we want to get transported by stories, and I've always loved stories.
Yes.
And it used to be I loved the story of the mass and the story of all of that. Still a fascinating story, but not the burden.
The dogma.
You know, cannot be born. It stifles a life of true spirit, for me.
Yes, and I mean, I just keep thinking of the word expansion when I'm watching, you know, you just kept expanding.
Kept expanding, and Winter's Tale, if you could actually kind of look at that scene by scene, and you could probably see a lot of the choices in the staging, there's a kind of deep sense of spirituality all through that play. Shakespeare wrote this play as a pre-Christian world. Apollo is the dominant god, the god of reason, the god of the sun. There's a profound sense of spiritual kind of law all the way through the play, but it's a poetic one rather than literal Christian dogma. Now, Shakespeare was not permitted to mention God or put God on the stage, but he did it all the time in disguise, you know? It was the disguise of... And I think I respond... It's very difficult not to feel the spirituality of that play, but it is not religious. But if you actually look at the staging, the way the oracle is brought on, the little altar that comes up with the sword of justice on it, this is very temple, church-like.
Yes.
You know, it's like it's all... But it's the theatre.
Yes.
The theatre becomes the temple, and which is what it was for the Greeks. And so I feel that even though I don't subscribe to any organized religion, I'm part of the tradition of art makers who connect to the life of the spirit. And if you look at that production, you could go to the Mass, the Seder, the Greek tragedy. You could see elements of all of that. You know, the ritualistic framework that people have always needed and enjoyed in some way.
Yes.
The theatre has appropriated that.
Yes.
And I've been part of that appropriation.
Yes, you have.
I've been part of that appropriation.
Yes, you have.
And I think what it's about is, of course, you actually hear Shakespeare. You actually hear that mind and what he's wrestling with. And it's like you have direct contact with that imagination. That's what people are really moved by.
Well, yes, I know that that's true, but, you know, I'm listening to you, and I can... your passion for it,
yeah.
You know, it's so clear.
Yeah.
And so... And it's interesting to me because you started out by saying, you know, I got into this conservative boys' school, and for my whole, you know, until I got out of high school, I didn't have any contact with that. But then you speak about those early days when you were play acting, and it sounds like it was there. Always there for you.
It was always there, and when I think about it, I mean, at the boys' school, we had theology and Christian doctrine every day.
Oof.
But it was normal. It was not, but it was, what was happening in that is that I was being exposed to St. Augustine and profound thinkers and, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas and, you know, as well as, you know, the Bible and religion. It was a great tradition of profound examination of why we're here and what the stories mean. But the Bible and all of that was never presented as literal to me in my education. It was always presented as there was a poetic dimension. It was a metaphoric dimension. It was like you had to figure out. So I think I was given a mindset through that religious education of looking at these stories as parables, as you have
stories.
To find the meaning. Not Genesis was never literal to us. The world wasn't literally created in 7 days. It's kind of baffling.
Well, you know what?
People take all that literally.
Well, see, now I wonder. I really wonder.
I wasn't brought up like that. The priests and nuns never taught us it was literal.
Really?
No.
You were lucky.
No, that's not how we were taught it.
Are you sure that you just didn't take it that way?
Maybe that, but I don't remember. That's not my memory of my.
I believe you, but it's very hard for me to think. It's really too bad we can't call up some of the boys who went to school.
Well, Karen Armstrong says this notion of being taking the Bible literally is very recent. For 1,700 years of people living with the Bible, it never occurred to people that it was absolutely literal. It's a poetic document that you must find at every point. The whole challenge of reading the Bible is to find love. Whatever the story is, you have to find love. That's your job.
Okay, now...
It's really...
But, and I agree with you, but I...
That's not what's happened to it.
No, and I would be really surprised to hear that a school in the 20th century was teaching that. I mean, that's really...
Well, I think I probably had an eccentric bunch.
Either that...
Now, there were some. The Redemptorist Fathers who used to come once every 6 weeks to do a retreat. They were obsessed with hell, I remember that. That was their big thing. But not the Jesuits and not the Christian Brothers and the Sisters of Mercy. They were not obsessed by hell, but the Redemptorist Fathers were, and we all knew that.
Yes. You sort of discounted them.
Well, no, they used to scare the hell out of a lot of us.
Oh.
They used to get some kids really scared, but a lot of people just rolled their eyes. This is at the age of 15.
Yeah.
We already knew this was perverse somehow to dwell on that. We were getting a real education.
Yeah, but rebellion at 15 and 16
absolutely.
Is kind of, you know, is really age appropriate.
Absolutely,
so,
absolutely. I don't know how we ended up talking about religion.
Well, it's the underpinnings in a really important way, not religion, but that whole idea of the metaphorical nature of the religious stories, the philosophy, the story aspect, really seems to be what captured you.
Oh, absolutely. I loved all those stories.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being very disturbed by the story of Abraham and Isaac, that God asked him to take his son up to the top of the mountain and sacrifice him. And I remember being very young thinking, I don't like this God. What kind of God would ask a father to do that? How is that a test of love? That father should be arrested and thrown into jail.
Right.
You know? I mean, any father that said, God told me to kill my son,
right.
We would put in prison. I had real trouble this at a very young age with the story of Abraham and Isaac. I can remember challenging a teacher with that story and arguing and trying to get it around to... I used to use the confessional as a place of arguing with the priests, too. I can remember going to a confession and arguing.
See, I'm sorry.
Really?
Michael, I'm sorry. I think you were an anomaly. I'm really sorry. I think...
Oh, I had other friends who were like it, too. A lot of my friends are not... They all think, well, It's I'm probably the most technically irreligious of all of my friends and family, but they all say I'm the most obsessed with it. That I talk about it more. I'm interested. I examine it more.
Yes. It's clearly a profound influence for you.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I am not. I reject.
Yeah, I know.
The rigid, dogmatic, institutional thinking of the church. I really.
Yeah.
Really, and I'd love to go with, from the Pope on. I would love to meet them toe to toe and argue every single point.
And I would love to have you do it. I'll tell you the truth.
I totally would. Karen Armstrong is my girl. I love her.
I do too. Do I have this wrong? Hasn't she sort of evolved to the sort of Eastern religions?
Well, she's evolved. She calls it the Golden Rule, and she says all the great religions have this in common. Treat other people the way you would like to be treated yourself.
Right.
It's at the core of every religion. Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism. They all, at the core, have the golden rule. It is the single hardest thing for all religious people to do.
Because we're so judgmental.
And they become committed to all the wrong things about religion.
Right.
And the last thing they are willing to do is to love their enemies.
Yes.
To treat other people as they would like to be treated. And it's the only important thing religion has to offer.
God, that's so lovely.
That is the most important thing for all religions to teach their children, to teach everybody. Don't treat anyone the way you don't want to be treated. And that's where she is now.
Yeah.
She's at that, if it's not informed by the golden rule, it isn't truly religious.
Yes.
So it's very disarming. None of the dietary laws, none of the moral strictures, none of those have any meaning if it doesn't come down to that. And you can justify it all you like. It's the hardest single thing for a truly religious person to do.
Yes. Well, a person who is in a particular religious...
Who subscribes to an orthodox religion.
Yes.
It is the hardest thing for them to do.
Yes, and it's why people are killing each other all over the place.
They have no problem doing that.
No. It's amazing.
Religion is... it's a profound perversion of religion that is used as an instrument of hate.
Yes.
But that's...
Yes.
That's its inevitable journey.
It's sort of in the service of a tiny ego. I can only feel okay.
Yeah, she talks about that too.
Yeah, I haven't read that in her, but it's clear, you know, that in order to feel okay about myself, I have to feel better than you, and if I feel better than you, then I don't mind treating you badly.
Oh, and if you subscribe to a religion that basically says, this is the absolute truth, this is right, and anyone who doesn't subscribe to this is the other, and subscribes is satanic,
right?
Then very quickly you don't have to respect the humanity, and you can easily eradicate them.
Yes.
The Bible is full of those stories. And that Bible is like gotten into our DNA.
Yes.
The Bible is filled with much more violence than the Quran. She points this out all the time. Look at all these. The Bible is filled with horror.
I know that.
And the hatred of the female.
Clearly.
Hatred of the female. They all have that in common, too.
Yes.
All the great religions.
Yes.
The hatred and fear of female sexuality, that it must be contained, is...
We're so dangerous.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about you.
Aren't we supposed to be talking about Perfect Mendacity?
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, it's world premiere.
Mm-hmm.
You've spoken to Jason.
I have. He's amazing.
It's really an incredibly timely play. He's responded to what's going on in the zeitgeist right now. He's responded to this as a writer, as an artist. He's looked at very specific things about people who... Well, the anthrax scare was a real trigger for him.
Mm.
And who would do that? And why would they do that? And what's its connection to government and the weaponizing of technology and chemistry that's going on all around the world? Terrorism. He's locked into that and made it a personal story about a man who, right out of university, didn't have a profound sense of morality and got caught up in a world of really dubious morality and murder without knowing it.
Wow.
And marries an Arab woman because he wanted someone who's submissive, and discovers a document in the company he works for that is exposing a world of hideousness that he's been part of. and his decision, once that becomes clear, what he decides to do with this is to actually find out a way to cheat the lie detector test that may expose him as knowing.
Wow. So it's a lie upon a lie.
And it's all about the extent to which, I mean, it becomes an image of how we lie in so many of our interactions.
In order to protect ourselves.
In order to protect ourselves. And how government and political economy must continue to lie very aggressively to survive.
You know, it's interesting because it's not that far off from what we were talking about religion, right?
I know.
I mean, it's this, I am this little thing that has to be protected at all costs, and never mind what I have to do.
That's right. And right? I don't want to know the consequences.
I don't want to know the consequences. And I don't care.
And I don't want to know where things come from. I don't want to know.
I just want to know that I'm okay.
I want to buy a cheap thing at Walmart, but I don't want to know the misery that has created the fact that this thing is
right,
cheap.
Right, and that I am perpetuating it.
I don't want to think about that.
No, I don't want to. No.
So deception, I mean, it's also connected to the notion of, you know, what is happening to the world, or with this notion of, you know, in order to have security, that we're willing to surrender.
Spirituality.
Almost everything about who we are that makes us human beings in order to be secure.
And that's one of the things that attracted you to it, right?
Yes. He also did Men of Tortuga for us, which I loved, and that was in my first season.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm committed to the notion of doing new work alongside the Shakespearean classics. We've got to have the new voices. So you can see Winter's Tale and Perfect Mendacity with the same company. I think that's pretty exciting.
So, but for you, it's the larger issues, right? It's
I love finding work to do that taps into what's going on in the world right now. I mean, and I love to remind people, yes, we do entertainment, and we're kind of the curators of a great tradition, but at the same time, we're responding to what's happening right now in the world, and we want to do work that makes you go able to cope what is happening, that you're able to come to us. It's as if you go to church, that's fine, but you will get a kind of spiritual nourishment and sense of belonging and sharing of ideas. Your isolation will be decreased, and you will lose any sense of fear of coping with the world that is incomprehensible right now. I think what Jason is doing as a writer is making something that's relatively really
ugly.
Hard to deal with and ugly and incomprehensible, making it actually comprehensible, even funny, and therefore we can cope.
Tolerate. We can tolerate.
We can cope. Yes. And do something about it.
Right. And so in this way, this is still your mission.
Yes.
I know. It's lovely. It's full circle, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. I'm not going. I know you have to talk to lots of other people. Yes. I want to say thank you so much for taking all this time with me.
I loved it. It was very stimulating. I completely forgot any sense we were actually recording.
Well, I'll edit it.
I didn't say anything vulgar.
No, you didn't. And you spoke in complete sentences.
I spoke in complete sentences. I didn't talk about politics.
No.
Because they always said, please don't talk about politics.
Well, I don't care.
And I wasn't supposed to talk about religion, but...
Oh, no. No, but you were absolutely charming.
That's it.
Thank you, Michael.
Not mean about it.
I can work the whole damn day, way into the night. Look like make out all right, and although I can fool you with my grown-up woman style, behind the woman.
So I am here with Jason Wells in a little conference room in the Oslo Theater, and Jason is a playwright.
That's right. So they tell me.
Yeah. That's not a designation a lot of people can claim as their primary life designation.
I guess not.
No. You're a lucky guy.
Mm-hmm. And it's fairly recent for me, too, so I'm still getting used to it.
Well, that's really what I want to know. Mm-hmm. I do this interview series called Anatomy of an Artist,
mm-hmm.
and I try to interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask them how it happened,
mm-hmm.
how they got captured, how it found them, how they found it, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you mind?
No, I think it's not really a simple story because it took me so long. I think that I always had, I started out as an actor. I'm still an actor. And I probably always had more opinions than I should have as an actor about writing and structure and how to tell a story and things like that. Not the best quality for an actor, but it didn't really occur to me that maybe I was actually a writer, too.
You want to tell me how you found acting?
I don't know if I really... I can't really pinpoint it to a moment, but my dad always loved movies, so he always took me to the movies ever since I was a little kid. He always took me to the movies that he wanted to see. So I probably saw a lot of movies that were too old for me.
Do you remember any?
Let's see. I think I'm almost embarrassed to say because I think a lot of people would say that my dad should not have taken me to see The Godfather.
How old were you?
I guess I was 10, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was absolutely fascinating. I was never bored for a second. And
apparently you were also not frightened or upset or any of those things.
No, not that I recalled in any way. I mean, it was all very, the whole thing was very emotional for me and... but not in a scary way,
mm-hmm.
just in a very exciting way. And I think just from the moment I realized that people could actually do this, could play these characters and not suffer the consequences
yes.
of playing the characters that they're playing and so forth, that this was something that people could actually aspire to do, I think I always thought of it that way, although I never told anybody. I didn't, my parents were not... I guess predisposed to think of as a career. So I don't think I told anybody until I got to college, and then I still didn't really tell anybody. I just started taking more and more theater classes and acting classes, and just allowed it to become sort of an inevitability.
What do you think they wanted you to do?
Well, my mother really wanted me to be a graphic artist because I had always been drawing ever since I was 5 years old. I was drawing, and I tried to do that for a while and sort of do that on a freelance basis.
Graphic artist is not that much more a secure career.
Well,
than
she was imagining like in advertising,
things course.
Like that, where you could actually make a living being an artist, because she recognized that I had artistic talent, and then of course she pushed me to do the thing where you could also make a lot of money
doing that.
So I think that was her ambition for me. And then, interestingly enough, I think she always wanted me to be a writer. And I probably should have listened.
What's that memory? I mean, what are you thinking that says to you that she would have wanted you to be a writer?
Well, it would manifest itself in different ways. Like she would say, see Jason Wells. Is a great name for a writer.
You're kidding.
I never adopted the C. Now I kind of wish I had, because then that would...
Because she was right.
Yeah, that would have been a dream come true for her if I had been C. Jason Wells, but I never adopted the C. But she would say things like that, I don't...
Well, that's not very veiled, is it?
No, not she was see Jason Wells. That's a great name for a writer, and I don't know that she had much of a picture of what that would be beyond that.
Right.
Except that I think she thought that she would like to see that on the cover of a book.
Now, did she have aspirations to write, your mom?
No, not at all. She came from a very modest background, and she didn't have a very high education or anything like that. I think she just. Sort of impulsive. She was a very impulsive person, and I think that she just conjured images of things like that,
Yeah.
She wouldn't know what I should write, or what kind of novel it should be, but she was pretty sure that would be a good name to be on the cover of a book.
That's great.
She's right.
Yeah,
she would now, if she was still alive, she would have to settle for Jason Wells on the cover of a book, and I think she would be fine. In fact, I just had Men of Tortuga published.
Oh.
And I'm sorry that she wasn't alive to see that.
I'll bet.
Because I think she would have settled for Jason Wells on the cover of a book.
And been very pleased.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think very pleased and proud of my dad, too.
Yeah.
Who also is no longer with us.
I'm sorry.
Well, they did pretty well. Good. My dad was 83 when he died, so I think that's okay.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so so you were moving steadily in the direction of acting.
Right.
Taking more and more classes, making it inevitable. I love that. and so then what?
I moved to Chicago to be an actor.
Where'd you come from?
St. Louis, Missouri. Ah. Mm-hmm. And Chicago was the closest city where I could imagine, you know, not having to go too far away, but still being able to make some kind of living as an actor. And in fact, in the early 90s, it was a much more reasonable plan. It was a much better place to make a living as an actor than, mm-hmm. than it has become subsequently. So at that time, I was doing pretty good for a while.
And as an actor?
As an actor, yeah. And so I thought it was time to move to L.A. around 96. And so my wife and I moved out to L.A., and it was a terrible decision. We had a nice place in Burbank, and we liked living there. We had a nice life there, but as far as the acting career was concerned, I realized almost immediately that it was just starting over,
yeah.
That I would just be starting from scratch.
Right.
And I just didn't have the energy anymore to really want to do that. So, you know, really, I just spent that whole time just working odd jobs and just trying to figure out what to do next. And at that time, a director friend called me and said that he was looking for screenplays. And he wanted to know if I knew any writers that might have a good screenplay. So I mentioned several people that I thought were worthy of that. And then it just suddenly occurred to me in the middle of that conversation, what's to stop me from writing a screenplay? What's the worst that could happen? It would just be another terrible screenplay. You know, is that the worst thing in the world?
Yeah, and you could be an out-of-work screenwriter as well as
an out-of-work actor. Exactly.
Right.
I realized there was absolutely no downside to this except for the work of writing a screenplay, and I wasn't doing anything else creative anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really just because of that, just because of the boredom that made me sit down and write this screenplay in a few weeks. And he liked it well enough, but nothing really happened with it for years. And we moved back to Chicago subsequently because we had enough of that in L.A. And I was doing a play at Steppenwolf with the director was Anna Shapiro. And at one point, and I'm not even sure where I got the impulse to do this because I don't even remember it being on my mind that much, but at one point I gave her the screenplay and just asked her to read it and tell me what she thought, and then I never heard from her for like 8 months. And then she called me and said that she had submitted it to a development workshop and that it had been accepted, and she forgot to tell me, and is that okay with me? So I said, yeah, I guess I'm not offended.
Uh-huh.
I guess that's okay with me. So I went to this development workshop, and while you're there, they ask you, what are you working on now? I mean, that's the big question.
Right.
When you get down there, what are you working on now? And you don't want to say, nothing, I'm not a writer.
No.
Because then you're saying, well, you've wasted your time and money.
Right.
On me.
On me,
yeah.
Right.
So... Yeah, I felt kind of cornered, and so I would say, I'm working on a play. I'm working on a play. And I don't want to be a liar.
God forbid.
God forbid I should be a liar. So
this is the basis of a lot of your work anyway, right?
This is what drives me to write is shame.
It is.
I kind of have to be pushed, and I kind of have to get myself into a place where I will feel guilty if I don't do the thing I said I was going to do.
This is so interesting for a number of reasons, because it seems like you do get put into these positions that you didn't necessarily put yourself in them. I mean, you didn't know about the development thing, so...
Yeah, that was pure luck. I mean, I gave her the script, but you know, I certainly didn't think beyond that. I thought maybe I would get some nice feedback from her. Yeah, so I certainly didn't expect that. And considering how lazy I am generally, that's pretty lucky.
Yeah,
that's a pretty lucky development. Otherwise, I probably never would have written anything again.
So here you are in the development thing, and you've said you're working on a play, so you pretty much have to.
So now I feel, so then when I get home, I feel like I got to write something.
Right, of course.
You know, I've got to do this or else I'm just a liar. So I wrote Men of Tortuga, and then and I wrote that as kind of a sort of a test play. To see,
the know, way you wrote the test screenplay?
Yeah, pretty much. I kind of just wanted to see. I mean, I don't really feel like I gave it as much thought as I would have if I had taken it very seriously, because I just wanted to have, you know, 100 pages of something that I could mail out to people to practice mailing things out.
And to prove that you actually had done it.
And to have actually done it, and then also to kind of use it as sort of a test ground to see how writers mail things out and what happens and what the process is.
Right.
And all of that. So I mailed that out to maybe 60 theaters. And I got 59 rejections and an acceptance from Steppenwolf.
Wow.
In my hometown, my favorite theater in the world.
Right.
So once again, I feel like I really...
lucked out.
Really lucked out in a big way. I mean, it's almost phenomenal. Well, plus, it was a cold submission.
Yes.
Which they subsequently told me never happens. That they would accept a play from a cold submission. That Ed Sobel, who was running the program, said he couldn't think of another example.
Wow.
Of that. So, yeah, I felt like I was really being pushed or impelled or whatever in the right direction at that point. And I had a wonderful experience at the First Look Festival at Steppenwolf with Tortuga. And based on the response from that, I was able to get an agent without trying. And I was able to get the attention from Oslo from that play without really working at it, which, like I say, is really lucky for a guy like me. I don't know. I should probably be expressing the necessity of hard work at this point, shouldn't I? instead of endorsing the idea that you can just sit still and get lucky.
Well, you know, I feel compelled to tell you that I hear this story over and over.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I guess there's probably a lot of laziness.
No. It's not about laziness. Yeah. It's about things happening as they somehow have nothing to do with you.
They just happen.
They just happen, yeah. Exactly. This is not to say that, you know, people don't work hard, but there does seem to be, for a lot of people, the synchronicity, the serendipity, the, I don't know what you want to call it, the kismet of it, you know?
And certainly everything doesn't come to me, and I don't, you know,
no, and
I don't
I'm
want to
not
give that impression, you know. But as far as becoming a writer, I certainly feel like I was led.
I know.
You know, whereas other people really, you know, strive. You know,
and quite often don't make it.
And quite often don't, I guess. Yeah. But just this particular aspect of my life, I felt sort of led into it in a very fortunate way, since it has proved to be very sort of personally gratifying.
So, yeah. It is what you
should have always done.
Right. Mm-hmm. It is you have found it, or it found you, whatever it is. Right?
Yeah, I often think that I'm sorry that I waited so long, and then I immediately remind myself that I really don't think I was ready.
Until
it happened. That, I mean, I look at things that I wrote in college and stuff like that, and it's terrible. And I'm easily discouraged. So I probably, if I had started earlier being terrible, I probably would have been easily discouraged and moved on to something else by now.
Yeah, you did. You were able to do this in a way that was so safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you were able to tell yourself over and over again that it didn't matter and it wasn't important, it was no big deal and all that stuff,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. When I was sending out the play, I had absolutely no ego as a writer.
Or expectation, you know, for that matter,
or expectation, right? Yeah. It wasn't what I had staked everything on, you know. It was more of just a test, you know, to see how this is done. It was more or less just something to do.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, so I think safe is a good word. I felt very safe through the whole thing.
Yeah, but, and again, in that way, you were protected, you know, so that you could risk this, so that you could take these chances and not take the, and be all right. if it didn't work out. But of course, as you say, and I can feel it from you, that this is really who you are.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think everything you just said is true. You know.
All right, so you want to talk a little bit about this play?
Sure.
Because now I didn't see Tortuga, and this, of course, hasn't happened yet, but in the little blurb that they gave me, it seems to me that a lot of your work has to do with truth, honesty, lies, and that sort of thing. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And I think it's subconscious as much as anything else, because I don't really think that much about what I'm setting out to say. But I think those things are always in my head, and they always become part of the currency of the characters.
Well, you know, the thing you were saying earlier about I had to do this, otherwise I would be a liar.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people wouldn't feel compelled to do it, and they wouldn't think it made them a liar. So this is clearly a powerful motivation for you, the whole idea of being honest or honesty or not being a liar.
Guilt is definitely a part of
guilt and shame. I see it coming.
My personality that it does drive me in certain directions a lot of the time, and in this case, it's certainly been a positive thing. I'll give you an example of how it sort of serves me in a positive way. This play, Perfect Mendacity, really the source of it was about 10 pages of dialogue that I wrote a long time ago, when I was interested in lie detectors, in polygraphs. Mm. And I had no play to hang that on. I was just interested in this subject, and I was thinking, well, here's how I'd beat a polygraph if it was up to me. And I wrote about like a 10-page dialogue where a character says, here's how you do it, which is complete fantasy. And then I put the 10 pages in a drawer, and I had no play to write to go with it. Years later, I was given the opportunity to apply for a Sloan Commission, which is a foundation that encourages plays about science and technology. And I immediately thought of the 10-page dialogue for the polygraph play. Mm-hmm. But my point is, only then did I sit down for about 10 minutes and think, I have a play. Mm-hmm. I've thought of the rest of the play.
Yes.
It was the impulse to please them. Somebody was actually asking. Otherwise, I probably would never have thought of that dialogue again, that polygraph dialogue, if somebody hadn't, you know, treated me like a writer. We understand you're a writer. Would you mind writing a play? And only then did I sit down and think, I guess I do have a play.
Yes.
And that was how the play got written. Otherwise, I don't know what would have become of that.
So are you working on anything else?
Yes, I am, but much slower than I would.
I wrote a book, and in it, I talk about the ways that people approach work. And one of the categories that I describe is assignment process.
Hmm.
And there are people, lots of them,
mm-hmm.
who work to assignment but not otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And for people like this, quite often they're very critical of themselves. You know, I can't make myself do anything, yada, da, da, da. And then the minute somebody asks them for something, suddenly it's there.
I had a guy say, I would really like to see a TV pilot. Have you ever thought of writing a proposed pilot for a TV show? And I said, I have never in my life considered writing a pilot for a TV show. I have absolutely no ideas for a TV pilot, and I don't anticipate ever having an idea for a TV pilot. And I went home that night, and I thought about it for about 15 minutes, and I thought, I have an idea for a TV pilot.
You,
and I sat down and I wrote.
You are the perfect example of assignment process. You are the perfect example.
I think so. Because as I say, right now I am working on something, but I'm working much slower than I've ever worked before. Really, I write very quickly. Somebody said I need a play.
Tomorrow,
Friday.
You're right. That's right.
It seems a little perverse, but it's okay. Well, I also have to control my fear of embarrassment.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of people are not afraid to show their work.
Yeah.
Do you know?
I do.
I think they're braver than I am in terms of being able to show their work at any stage, even if it's just awful.
And you're afraid because?
It's just the idea of
showing somebody something that's so out of shape that they might secretly roll their eyes.
God forbid.
Yeah, God forbid. I think holds me back quite a bit. And I'm aware of that, and I actually think getting over that will probably make me a better writer.
Wow, really? Because?
Yeah. Because I admire people who take chances. I admire people who do things that are bold. And you can't do that without the risk of disappointing people or of failing. And I completely believe in the things that I've written so far, but I also have to recognize that there are chances to take still.
Yes.
You know, that there are things that I just want to try. And I'm getting a little more confident as I go along because things that I thought were risky have so far had a tendency to pay off, and people have sort of been getting things. And so
you took the chances and it paid off.
Yeah, so I'm a little more encouraged to think that maybe it's okay, you know, to take bigger risks or just to write for writing's sake and see what people think. And
do you like to write?
Yeah, I love to write when I'm doing it. I don't like the part where I'm not writing. When I'm actually doing it and it's really kind of clipping along, there's not a lot of angst about it, you know? I mean, I'm not spending a lot of time furrowing my brow and really agonizing over it. When it's happening, it's really happening.
Yeah, I know, and it's a wonderful feeling.
It's exhilarating, and there's nothing like seeing, you know, like seeing the 50 pages that, you know, that I wrote or whatever, you know, and going over it. So, yeah, in that sense, I really like it. And I guess in general, I just like being a writer.
Okay, so much as I would love to continue this, because I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, me too.
Clearly we need to stop. Jason, I'm looking forward to seeing the play. I am looking forward to hearing everything that you write.
Well, that's nice.
You're very brave.
Well,
just say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason Wells.
Thank you very much.
I really did want to continue that interview, but we were time limited. And there were people waiting to talk to Jason behind me. And I actually did the interview with Michael after Jason, and he was waiting to talk to me. And people were waiting to talk to him after me. So we had to stop. But I really enjoyed both of these interviews. They were stimulating. Well, you can tell by listening to me. So, I have to stop now because I've run myself out of time. So I need to thank Josh Hackney, as I always do, for the way in which he saves me from all of the technological problems I am heir to, and to tell you that I hope that you got something that you can use from this show, something that gave you information you didn't have or stimulated you or interested you, but something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and sister